de cómo la gente se comunica, cómo la gente interactúa, cómo se conectan los puntos. Y por ejemplo, cómo se agarra una idea y varias personas pueden aportar la misma idea, pero de diferentes perspectivas. Lo importante es que vean un problema de diferentes ángulos y puedan dar soluciones muy interesantes a los problemas. Y eso les va a dar Steven. Ustedes, Steven Carlos.
Buenos días. That's all of my Spanish as well. I know a few other words, but I understand I'm not allowed to repeat them. I ran the title of this session through Google Translate, and that's what came out: models, technological resources, and knowledge management. And I took that as a challenge to make a single presentation out of those three concepts. I think there is a thread that they have in common and that I'd like to explore in this talk today. You might be wondering about the image. That figure that you're looking at is actually about 100 feet away from here. You might not know that. It's in behind the conference center, down a little bit. That's the back wall of the conference center. And I looked at it, and obviously it's like an Egyptian god or something formerly in better days. And it just struck me as a metaphor of how something that was very central and very important, as this obviously once was, can be, become something that you find out behind the conference center, in between the garbage cans. I found that very interesting. Let me introduce this with some context. And the context is given to us by a board member from the University of Virginia on the forced resignation of their president for being too slow to take up change. And the context is that we believe higher education is on the brink of a transformation. Now that online delivery has been legitimized by some of the elite universities. I think the first part is true. We are on the brink of a transformation. I think the second part is a bit overstated. We would have been on the brink of a transformation whether or not Harvard and MIT and Stanford decided to play along. In fact, I would argue, and I think I can make a good case, that they have been historically the last to get the picture, and their joining on now is a sign that the transformation has indeed come, and we're now dealing with the aftermath. What is this transformation? Well, in the session before this, Juan Luca, sorry, it's very small text, was here from Blackboard to tell us that mobile technology is here. And it's not just that mobile technology is here, it's that the arrival of mobile technology, everything from your smartphone to an iPad to other tablets to laptops to the GPSs, cameras everywhere, is changing the nature of what we do. It's changing the nature of production. And he pointed out a couple of examples. He talked about the way the book now goes from whoever created it to the publisher to an online vendor straight to your mobile device. He talked about the way this happened with Napster and with music as well. And he's also talking about the way this is happening in educational resources. And certainly, the large learning management system companies like Blackboard are looking very closely at aligning their business models to be more like, oh, I don't know, Kinect or iTunes as vendors of this learning content rather than providers of learning services to colleges and universities. Although, if they can hang on to that business, they'd like it too. Online learning is here. Canada, where I come from, where it's not nearly as warm as it is here. Actually, though, today it is, so I'm told. Has something like 100,000 FTEs. That's how we count courses in Canada. It's full-time equivalency. So it's like having 100,000 online students in Canada. We were just told, just a few minutes ago, about a program to roll out computers to teachers in Panama. The Balboa Project had to train 4,000 teachers, rolling out 90,000 computers per year. I hope that number's accurate. I think yes, it might it be is. A typo. It is accurate. Excellent.
20,000 teachers.
And we're told that this will allow that all teachers are transformed into content managers. But the significant point of the presentation was that this isn't something that just happened. You know, we were all going along merrily, and then all of a sudden we had online learning. This is a result of programs that have been put into place, funding arrangements that have been put into place in order to make this happen. Because, as William Graves said, we're addressing a pressing need. Now, not everybody is there. What, bus? I was told not to get onto that bus. So it struck me as an appropriate analogy for how university professors are looking at online learning, and the way they're looking at online learning is as something frightening and fearful and going too fast and probably going to take them someplace they don't want to go. And as a result, and this is George Siemens talking here, who's my partner in many online endeavors, leadership in traditional universities has been grossly negligent in preparing the academy for the economic and technological reality it now faces. Things are changing, and they're changing in ways even those institutions who are now getting on the bus don't quite understand. So that's the context. That's where we are. Now for the challenging part. Let's try to make a talk out of the three themes of this session. So we'll begin with models. I'm assuming models is like, I'm hoping Google Translate got it right, and it meant models as ways of seeing the world and not models as simulations. But I think either way, it'll work okay. Sorry, I'm not used to carrying a mic around with me. Here's how I want you to think about this. It's a little bit different. The internet is a model. And if you think about it, what else could it be? It's not reality, therefore it must be the model. If you take the idea literally, it's a model of the whole world. Or maybe a model of what we think about the whole world, or maybe both. But you have to take this literally. You have to understand that if we're thinking of the internet as a model, we're thinking of the whole internet. And that's been a theme that's gone through a lot of my work in the past, especially when I talked about organized and structured representations like the semantic web, where everything is expressed in nice, neat triples. Jack jumps over the dog. Now that's the semantic web representation of the world. But our representation of the world is a lot more complex. It's a lot more messy. And if we want to understand what kind of model we should use, to represent the world, to represent knowledge, to represent learning in order to cope with those catastrophes. It's the internet as a whole. And the internet as a whole does not look like many of our management structures. You know, models are hard to do. Just ask Google. You can't just come up with a plan and say, we're going to represent, social systems this way and expect it to work. Google has been at this for a long time because its main product, which is search, has gradually been eroding as people, instead of going to a central search engine, which is full of ads anyways, are asking each other where to find things and what's worth reading. Google tried something called Orkut. I always want to pronounce it Orkut, but I'm told the pronunciation is Orkut. It's named after the guy who developed it. It looked like a lot like Facebook. It became very popular in Brazil, but not elsewhere. Then Google tried something called Google Wave. And Google Wave was very much a content-centered approach. And the idea is you'd have these waves of content flowing, and people would join these waves and add their content to these waves. A lot like a discussion board thread, except a wave. And that is now dead. And now Google is coming out with something called Google Plus, which is kind of like Facebook again, only not really Facebook. And again, to my perception, and you know, my perception is admittedly only one perspective, but to my perception, it continues to struggle. Google Plus isn't the model either. And so it's really difficult to come up with the right model. You can't just pull something out of the air and say, this is it. You know, you can't just create a Venn diagram or a list of 10 elements or something everybody else wants to do. You have to look at the model that we're actually using, which is the internet as it is. Real life. Where's the e-learning in real life? That's what we're modeling. This here is a video. It's a pretty interesting video. I won't play it. I don't have time. I have better videos for later. But it's a video of some police officers in Canada going through training. West Midlands Police, so that would be Britain. And they're using actual buildings and actual people. And the reason why they're doing that is because actual people act in random, chaotic ways that are very difficult to emulate using an algorithm. But this is still e-learning. You might ask, where is the e-learning? Well, they've recorded a video, and they put it up on YouTube, and that made it e-learning. But the target for that e-learning isn't the police officers. The police officers are practicing in their room. The target for that e-learning is the audience consisting of members of the general public. And this is a bit of an aside, but it seems to me there's the not too subtle message that they're telling people, if you go up against the police, look, they've been training. I don't know if that's the intended message, but that's what I got out of it. You can't always predict what you're going to get out of these things. There's a concept called the flipped classroom that really builds on this whole idea of learning from video. It's traditionally attributed to a man called Carl Fish, although I think iterations of it have been around for as long as there's been home television and home video. And the idea of the flipped classroom is that instead of presenting content using lectures or films or videos in the classroom, you give the students educational materials that they can consume at home, instead of giving them homework. And so they go home, they watch their video, they come into the classroom, then they do the interactive bit. And this diagram is a representation by Jackie Gerstein of the flipped classroom, the full picture is what she calls it. And she's talking about four basic elements of the flipped classroom. The activity, the concept exploration, the making of meaning and demonstration. But I look at that and it reminds me of my own very simple, not original learning theory that somebody probably already said before me. To teach is to model and demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. And we can get really complicated trying to do more than that. But that's what's happening here with this version of the flipped classroom, where the teaching is the modeling and demonstrating using in-person demonstration to model and the videos to demonstrate. But just as importantly, if not more importantly, you have the students doing their part, the practicing, the doing over and over. I don't know if you've ever seen The Karate Kid, but a big part of The Karate Kid is wipe the car, wipe the car, wipe the car. Because it's the practicing that produces the learning. But it's not just the practicing, it's the informed, reflective practicing. Doing this, wax goes on, wax comes off. Wax. People know it, people have seen the movie. You remember, right? But you remember because you think about it and you know, oh yeah, it relates to how you defend against anyhow. Now, practice and reflection, and these things are very important in learning. And that's what the flipped classroom model brings out. Models. George Siemens and I are the originators, and we will take credit for that, of a model called the Massive Open Online Course. We're not the originators of the term, and we're not necessarily fond of the term. And actually, I think if you questioned us, we would deny just about every element of the term. Nonetheless, that's the term we were given. Massive Open Online Course. And the idea here is to create this model of modeling and demonstrating, practice and reflecting in an online environment. And the idea of the MOOC, as it has come to be called, the way we've developed it, is that we create an environment where this practice and reflection can take place. Well, there have been other MOOCs, including one brought to us by our friends from Blackboard, who presented in the earlier session of this group. The Blackboard MOOC featured Curtis J. Bonk, who's a really interesting guy. I like him a lot. I like his lightsaber. I don't know how that works over audio, but no, I'm just kidding. And it was interesting because the Bonk MOOC, or the Bonkian MOOC, or the Blackboardian Bonkian MOOC, I'm just kidding, received a fair amount of criticism, and I think it was a bit unfair to Kurt, but it was because of the way it was set up where it focused a great deal on the content. It was offered inside a traditional learning management system, and that learning management system, of course, is Blackboard. And as a result, the activity component that you would expect wasn't there. And it's funny how you can have the same term, MOOC, but you have two different models, right? Now you have the model where we have a lot of discussion, a lot of interaction, and that forms the core of our MOOCs. You have another MOOC where the model was content presentation, where you have online synchronous sessions, and that forms the core of the MOOC. What I found interesting, though, was that the person who received, I think, the most education from that MOOC was Kurt Bonk, who gave it, and he remarks that he found himself teaching more people in one class than he had in 23 years of teaching. So even though the model isn't exactly the same, it's still a game changer. And that's what George Siemens and I found when we offered our MOOC. Our very first MOOC, we had 2,200 people. Our most recent MOOC, we had about 3,000 people. This is a game changer. This changes dramatically what is happening in the field of online learning. But making it massive, simply for the sake of making it massive, isn't going to be sufficient. In our opinion, we want to make it massive in the right way. But television has a massive audience, but we wouldn't call, you know, an episode of Dallas a massive open online course. That would be ridiculous. A radio station will have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of listeners, but, you know, the top 45 in the afternoon is not a massive open online course. As Alan Levine commented in an article, we want to scale our MOOCs fractally, not arithmetically. And that's a hard distinction to explain, but I can explain it like this. You could get to 100 things by getting 100 of the same thing. 100 red Legos would give me 100 things. But you get a much more interesting 100 things if you get 100 different things. Red Legos, blue Legos, those little motors, some wheels, some strings, some pulleys, a table, and so on. You can do a lot of stuff with 100 different things. You can make it interact because it's different from each other that you can't do with 100 things that are the same. And that's what he means by scaling it fractally. We scale it by iterating from one person to the next, to the next, to the next, each person saying something different to the next, rather than one person at the center saying the same thing to everyone. This talk here that we're doing right now, that I'm giving right now, this talk is a success to me only if all of you go off and have your own bilateral conversations. And to me, your conversations are the content of my talk. What I've said here, the stuff I'm actually saying, isn't intended for you to remember or learn or memorize. That would be ridiculous. What I'm trying to do here, what I ought to be trying to do, is to present the sort of stimulus that will cause you to think and interact with other people. And that thinking and interacting is the content of the thought, of the talk. You know, it's interesting. Albert Sangra talked again in the earlier session about learning ecologies. And it's a model, and it's a more appropriate model than, say, the learning management system model or the production of industrial content model that we have been using for online courses in the past. What is a learning ecology? He quoted Barron, and I really liked this definition, and so I want to steal it. A set of contexts made up of configurations of activities, materials, resources, and relations generated in physical or virtual spaces which provide opportunities for learning. So, now, that's going to lead us to our second section, which is technological resources. And right away, I think we have to understand that given the model that we've just been talking about, what we have to say about technological resources can't be what we might have thought about technological resources. We're not talking just about hardware and web pages and MS Word documents. We need to broaden our picture quite a bit. Right off the bat, we know that we need to move from the physical into the digital. And Raphael Rangel Sostman, I'm apologizing if I'm mispronouncing your name, talked this morning about the need to use digital editions. And what I found interesting about his talk, aside from the fact that I could understand anything of it given that it was in Spanish, so kudos to him for presenting well, or maybe I've totally misrepresented it, I hope not. But what I got out of this was there's a progression that we're going through, right, from the printed book to the e-book to the online course. And, you know, those are just names for a series of technological changes that are happening. And we're going from something that is very static, very fixed, and also very expensive to something that's more dynamic, something that we can share, something that's more green, to, in the end, something that's quite a bit more interactive, that embodies activities and exercises, that has more of a pedagogical focus. And it struck me that over time, as everything moves into this digital environment, the distinction we would draw between a book and a course disappears. There is no difference between a book and a course. They are one and the same thing. It's just that the book has changed so much and the course has changed so much and they've merged in a single direction to become some new kind of online entity. As we speak, and literally as we speak, it's happening right now, and if I wasn't here, I'd be listening to it online. There's a conference taking place in Paris, sponsored by UNESCO, on open educational resources. And what UNESCO has been doing with some success is promoting the production of open educational resources, but more importantly, to my mind, convincing governments that the educational resources that they produce or that they fund ought to be licensed in such a way that they can be freely shared and freely reused. Now, this brings the price of educational resources down to zero, except for the time it takes you to read them, or to use them, or to interact with them. That is, again, completely a game changer, and to our people in Blackboard, we're thinking that maybe they can become the bookseller of educational resources. It's going to pose a conundrum, because how do you make a profit selling something at $0? But it's going to happen. Online resources will be open. Online software will be open. This is something Blackboard is recognizing. Blackboard recently acquired Moodle Rooms. Moodle Rooms is a company that hosts a version of Moodle. Moodle is an open source learning management system. Understanding how the arrival of mobile, the arrival of internet everywhere, the changing models of online commerce, understanding these leads us to understanding how learning is going to be offered in our own institutions by the providers that we use today in very different ways. But the really, really important part of open educational resources is the part that's happening below the surface, is the part that's happening outside our classroom. You remember I talked about the flipped classroom. Well, what happens, think about this, what happens when you tell a student, especially a young student, that they need to sit down and watch a video? Do they watch the video that you gave them? Or do they watch something else? Probably they watch something else. They watch some guy skateboarding off a roof and learn about physics and gravity and emergency health care. they exchange comments with their friends. They watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, or in Canada, they watch American Idol. In America, they watch Canadian Idol. Actually, no, they don't. They watch American Idol, too. And so on, right? What's happening on the real internet is this massive sea of sharing. Go to sites like Reddit. Go to sites like Tumblr. Go to YouTube. Even though Google is trying to stop people from downloading stuff from YouTube, go to YouTube. You see this huge, massive amount of sharing. There's all kinds of stuff happening. Once you give people the freedom to start looking at whatever content they do, they start looking at whatever content they want. That's the open educational resources environment, if you will, below the waterline. All the stuff that UNESCO is doing, that our institutions are doing, the formal stuff hides a much greater activity that is happening below the surface. And it's activity that involves not just resources. This is really important. Facebook's come out with something called the Open Protocol. And the Open Protocol is a simple little system that allows applications that run on Facebook to make statements about things that happen inside that application. You can think of it, for example, say a Foursquare application where you check into a site. It's a way of formalizing, Fred checked in to the Starbucks on York Street or whatever. And the idea here is that these activities are represented in a machine-readable format, much the way RSS represented content in a machine-readable format in 1995. That means that our open educational resources include not only educational contents, not only ebooks, not only lessons, not only conversations, but the actual activities that we undertake in all of these different things. What we want to do, what we will do, is capture this process. And I've always thought that what people should be doing in promoting open educational resources is capturing the process, capturing whatever they do, capturing real life and making that available online. Just some quick remarks about knowledge management, and then I'll move over to allow the next speaker to speak. In real life, you get things like this. This is from a blog from a 9-year-old student, again in Britain, who started taking photographs of school meals. And the school's reaction was that they will no longer allow their meals to be photographed. Exactly the wrong response, right? And they now know this, they've recanted, and they're actually serving food for their meals, which is even better. The school's approach was knowledge management. They try to control the knowledge. Knowledge management doesn't work. You can't control the knowledge. And the reason why you can't control the knowledge, and if you go to my website, click on this link. And what it is a series of dominoes. And you have a little tiny domino, and it tips over, and a slightly bigger domino, and it tips over, and a slightly bigger domino, and it tips over. You click one little tiny chiclet-sized domino, and you tip over a domino the size of a house. Because a domino represents stored or potential energy. And so a very small domino can result in a very large domino falling over. Now, how do you control that? You have to control every small domino in the world. But you can't control every small domino in the world. Is this going to work? It's not going to work. If you've ever seen... Oh, okay, maybe it will. This is the internet. This is what you're trying to control. And this is called a murmuration. And it's 300,000 birds. If you imagine 3 billion birds, that would be the internet. There's nobody in charge, there's no leader, you can see form, you can see organization, but what you don't see is management. And what's really interesting is any one of those birds can change the direction of the whole flock, and anyone, literally, there is no best bird. Again, the concept is ridiculous. So William Graves talked about education as catastrophe, education versus catastrophe, but he presented it in a management kind of perspective, right? where we're all having some kind of singular objective, but it won't work. You can't manage your way out of catastrophe. We hear a great deal in the area of knowledge management about collaboration, working together, pulling together, all lining up behind the same objective. But in reality, we're all like birds flying in the air. And each of us has a very important thing that governs us, and that is to not fall. Because then we would die. No, literally, each one of us has our own objectives, our own direction we want to fly, our own sphere of interest immediately around us. We're not all working together. We're each of us working individually, but in a common, complex environment. Instead of collaboration, we should be talking about cooperation. Instead of collaboration, everybody being the same, everybody hearing the same message, we should be talking about cooperation. Each of us speaking in our own authentic individual voice and communicating with each other. And then, like the murmuration of birds, finding together our own direction. And we need to be designing our educational systems in that way. There's a company called Valve that is organized in exactly that way. I use products that they have produced on my computer, so it does work. It's not always easy and it's not always perfect, but it is possible to have a company that ships product even though there are no managers. Now, we hear a lot about knowledge management. We hear a lot about what's replacing knowledge management, which is analytics, which is kind of like managing the knowledge after it has taken place or after the fact. But what we need to understand is that in order to understand what's happening on the wider internet, we need to be able to look at all of these different areas of the internet. We can't understand what our students are learning just by looking at their performance in our private system. We have to look at their total overall actions on the internet. And that's how our courses should be constructed. And that's how our MOOCs should be constructed. Downes' law of MOOCs, if you will. If it isn't a web, if it isn't a network, if it isn't a murmuration, then it isn't a massive open online course. Now, our next course that we're offering, we've been offering them since 2008, will start in October. It's called Ed Futures. I'm a little bit worried because it's got way too many collaborators, including a bunch of people from the management set. We've got the Chronicle of Higher Education, we've got the Gage Foundation, EduCause. Everybody wants to be a part of it, which is nice, and we're happy to share. But it will be interesting to see how their management perspective comes against our murmuration perspective. So that's the talk. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I went about 5 minutes over, but I really appreciate your patience and your time. Thank you.